For the week of February 28th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 43, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And trapped on Shutter Island, I'm Michael Giltz.
I guess you guys don't like my announcer voice.
No, I love it, actually. I think it's really funny.
Well, joining you, Michael Giltz, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, and social media maven Karen Woodward. Later on in the podcast, we'll be doing some predictions, and we have Ann Thompson from IndieWire joining us from Thompson on Hollywood, her blog. She's going to tell us basically whether we're idiots or not, along with Eric Childress from eFilm Critic and Cinematical. He's an entertainment journalist based in Chicago. I believe he's the vice president of the Chicago Film Critics. And they're going to show up and tell us whether we are out of our minds for our predictions or whether we're actually geniuses.
About the Oscars.
Sorry, yes. Did I not mention the
Oscars? Genii.
Okay, well, the Oscars are this Saturday. This Sunday. The Spirit Awards are this Saturday. We took a week off, so hopefully, absence made the heart grow fonder and you missed us for a week. So we've got a lot of news to cover. And I guess, as always, we'll start with the week's box office news, at least the North American box office news.
That's right. And at number one this week for the second week in a row is Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island. Now, long after his creative peak, Scorsese is proving a commercial hit. Shutter Island grossed $22 million. It's $75 million total. At number two was the Bruce Willis, Tracy Morgan rehash of 80s cop movies called Cop Out with $18.5 million. At number three, a very well-reviewed horror film called The Crazies, a remake starring Timothy Olyphant of Deadwood. That grossed $16.5 million. That's a big success. We'll see how it holds over the next few weeks. At number four, Karen's favorite film, Avatar, which grossed $14 million, past $700 million total in U.S. box office. Unbelievable. And at number five is Percy Jackson and the Olympians, which hopes to become a franchise, but I don't know. It's grossed $9.8 million, $71 million total. Unless it doubles that total overseas, I don't see it happening. And other than that, the rest of the top 10 are some holdovers, like the success Valentine's Day, which grossed $100 million, Dear John at $72 million, and Crazy Heart, which is the only film to really capitalize on its Oscar nominations. It grossed $2.5 million this week. It's at $25 million total. And for a small film that was almost dumped straight to video, that's a terrific success.
I would agree with that. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but I do plan on seeing it in theaters before Sunday so that I can at least know what's going on when
it's a fantastic movie. When Jeff Bridges wins.
Yeah, because, that's an early prediction. But yes, I believe he's.
It's pretty close to fact. I thought it was interesting that The Crazies got good reviews because the trailer was laughable. It's terrible. Don't you remember that?
With the pitchfork scraping along the ground. It was hilarious.
It was embarrassingly hilarious.
Well, it's got a good cast. I do like Timothy Olyphant, and it's not my type of movie. I almost went to see it, but I did go check out Shutter Island, the Scorsese film. I couldn't bring myself to see Cop Out. I just couldn't. But I did see Shutter Island, and it's just, my friend said, oh, Martin Scorsese's really lost. And I said, yeah, you know what? He's lost it since, Goodfellas in 1990. That was his last, great film. So, he had a great run from the 70s to the 1990, and there's no reason to expect anything from him ever again.
Nice.
Apparently, he is doing some 3D work now in Paris. His next film may be in 3D.
He's just checking it out, or does he have a project?
I think he's got a project, and I shouldn't have brought this up because I really don't have all of the details. And so,
wow.
But I heard from a very trusted source that he is thinking of going 3D, at least for his next film.
Well, at least with Martin Scorsese, it'll be a movie that needs to be done in 3D as opposed to like Clash of the Titans where they shot it in 2D and just slapped 3D on top of it.
Yeah, I've actually heard that the 3D is not looking so good in Clash of the Titans. But again, I have not seen it. So I've just heard this from people who are basically stereoscopic engineers. So they're very picky about their 3D.
Well, I'm going to see Alice in Wonderland in 3D because that's how it was made. But I will absolutely refuse to see Clash in 3D because it was made in 2D. It's meant to be seen that. Why pay an extra $4 for the pleasure of wearing those stupid glasses?
Well, I'm sure that'll make the difference between it being a, top 10 movie and completely tanking.
Well, do you know how Alice in Wonderland was thought of in 3D and how it was created in 3D and Tim Burton's process for that?
No, tell us.
No.
I guess he was on set the first day or two and trying to shoot this thing with the two camera system with, you know, with a 3D system, a 3D camera system. And it was just so frustrating. It was taking so long that he said, you know what, guys, go home. I'm going to shoot this in 2D and you can fix it all in post. Now, mind you, he knew that there were companies like In3 or Sassoon that were out there that could do that. So they had a stereoscopic engineer on set the whole time. So it was crafted with 3D in mind, but he shot it in 2D because he just couldn't be bothered with all of the technical hoo-ha that Jim Cameron used to shoot Avatar.
Technical hoo-ha.
Hey, I just made that up, by the way. I coined that phrase as we spoke.
Well, as long as it was designed, I mean, the production, the style, the look, the way he placed the camera, I mean, whether you have the actors with, you know, things all over their bodies to do capture motion or you do it in post or whatever, as long as the intention is to create a 3D film, that seems fine to me.
Well, later on during the podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about Cop Out, or at least Kevin Smith. I don't want to jump ahead to Big Deal or Big Whoop, but for those of you who have been following the news, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Of course.
And I don't want to, I guess we're going to be talking a little bit about Alice in Wonderland as well, and the controversy Disney stirred up with its release date, not for the film, but for the DVD. As I mentioned, we're going to be doing some Oscar predictions, which we should get to in a minute. Jay Leno has returned to Late Night. We're going to talk a little bit about an interesting website that is trying to do something different on Wall Street. So that, I think, will be an interesting conversation. And, of course, we always do Big Deal or Big Whoop. And this week in Inside Baseball, we'll be talking about video on demand streaming right to your television set. But first, I guess, should we start our Oscar predictions?
Yes, my favorite thing.
All right. Well, let's get Ann Thompson from IndieWire, where her blog is Thompson on Hollywood, and Eric Childress from eFilm Critic and Cinematical. I believe he also has a radio show on WGN in Chicago. Indeed, he does. He is a regular weekly guest with Nick DiGilio, and that can be found 7:20 a.m. in Chicago. He is also the vice president of the Chicago Film Critics Association. So now that I've introduced them, I can actually dial their phone number.
Excellent. Hello.
There's Anne.
Hello.
Now, Anne, you should know Eric Childress is on the line from Chicago.
Hello, Eric. How are you?
Hello. Okay, how are you?
Good.
As well, we have Karen Woodward and Michael Giltz. I almost said Karen Giltz and Michael Woodward, which...
If only she were Karen Giltz.
Wow.
Ooh.
What's going on?
Heard it here first.
Should I leave the room? Well, Anne, Eric, thank you for joining us. Karen, Michael, and myself figured we'd cover the Oscars by making a few predictions on some of the categories and have some experts on, such as yourselves, to tell us, as Karen mentioned moments ago, how dumb we are or whether we're actually geniuses for our selections.
Genius.
Happy to oblige.
Now, I guess in prep, you kind of mentioned that some of the technical categories were more interesting than the actual big categories like Best Director or Best Actor. So what about Best Sound Mixing?
Well, actually, the issue with the sound is that, of course, Hurt Locker just... Well, you guys go ahead. You're picking first.
That's right. I'm going to go with... I guess I'm sound mixing sound in. I'm just going to go with the Avatar sweep.
Sound mixing? Okay, yeah, I'll go with Avatar.
I'm going to be a contrarian and go with Hurt Locker. And
so now we have to respond?
Yeah.
And you were saying?
Well, I was basically saying that because Hurt Locker won with the sound, the audio guild or whatever it is, the question is, Avatar is going to win one of them, which or both of them, and is Hurt Locker going to split? And so I'm going to say with sound mixing, I'm sticking with Avatar for this. I think Avatar could win it, or it's very close. It's a real duel between Avatar and Hurt Locker.
Yeah, I actually think this is, of all the technical categories, I think this is sort of the one to sort of keep an eye on, because I think it's going to be the one, the duo of categories that sort of makes or breaks what film is going to win the most Oscars that night. I'm not being wishy-washy when I say that I actually have a suspicion that the two categories are going to split. I have a feeling Hurt Locker is going to win sound mixing, and Avatar is going to win sound editing. The guild split them that way. It's very possible that Avatar could win both of them, but I could have it backwards. Avatar could win sound mixing, and Hurt Locker could win editing. But you know, it seems funny that you know Hurt Locker movie, you know, that is you know about explosives and whatnot, would not win at least one of the sound awards, even though the whole purpose of the movie is not exploding stuff. But yeah, I'm actually going to go with Hurt Locker for mixing and Avatar for sound editing.
And that is something for people watching the show to check out for. If they see Avatar sweeping or Hurt Locker sweeping, they can look for an upset in Best Picture. You know, that's a good indicator of where the people are leading. When you see somebody, right. You know, who picks up Best Film Editing, who picks up Best Sound Mixing, all that stuff gives you a hint of, as far as where they're going to go when they get to the final awards.
And that's the truth.
The reason we said that that the technicals are where the real duel occur, all throughout the categories, you could see Hurt Locker versus Avatar, you know, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult to choose a lot of the time.
Well, indeed, Best Film Editing is Avatar, District 9, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, or Precious. I would have to go with Avatar on this one.
I'm going to go with Inglourious Basterds and Sally Menke, because it's beautifully edited, and I think they really do like the movie. And I think that's going to be an indication that Avatar and Hurt Locker are not going to sweep anything.
Well, I think we can safely say there won't be a sweep of any kind. I can't see that happening. But at any rate...
Wait. Karen,
go ahead.
Who do you pick?
First, are we on sound editing?
Film editing.
Oh. I'm going with Hurt Locker.
Okay. Sorry, Anne. Didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I should wait. What's your vote, Sperling?
Oh, Avatar. I don't know why, but I'm really just taking a stab in the dark and thinking that Avatar will run away with most of the big tech awards. Although I guess I should have looked up who won the Ace Eddie Award, shouldn't I?
That would help you out a little bit.
Yeah, it was Hurt Locker.
Hurt Locker. Award.
I think it may be Hurt Locker.
Yeah, then I should have looked that up before saying Avatar, because it's definitely going to be Hurt Locker. So I definitely got that one wrong.
But what, you know,
I have
when
to warn you guys, I always win my office pool.
But of course, when a film isn't sweeping, then that's where you see things like, you know, a respected industry veteran in film editing or cinematography or costume design, all these areas where if one film's not dominating, all bets are off. And I don't think the guilds are necessarily the best indication. You know, when you're not checking them off just random for one movie, suddenly, you know, the Oscar voters can be very mercurial. But of course, look at costume design. There's no Hurt Locker and no Avatar there. So that's wide open. I'm going to go for The Young Victoria and Sandy Powell, because I think it's one of the best films of the year and they did a great job. What do you think, Sperling?
Well, also nominated in that category are Bright Star, Coco Before Chanel, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, and
Ooh.
Nine. And quite frankly, I would have to go with, I don't know, I haven't seen two of those movies. Maybe, I don't know, Bright Star or Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. I'll just throw that in there.
Young Victoria, because everybody likes a corset.
And I would have to say you're right. And the Costume Guild went with Young Victoria. I think that one's pretty clear that it's going to win.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm also going with Young Victoria. I think if there would be an upset in that category, it might be Dr. Parnassus, but I am finalizing with Young Victoria myself.
Wow, I just cannot win for losing here. I really should have done my homework on this.
Yeah, Sperling, you totally suck. You have to go on instinct here.
Normally, I'm really good at this, and I do a lot of research beforehand, and I know who's won an Oscar and when. And
move on.
Okay, Best Cinematography, in my opinion, is one of the more interesting and... Well, I don't want to say disputed, but it certainly is a toss-up, because you have Avatar, which was using technologically advanced and first-of-their-kind cameras.
Yawn.
Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, and The White Ribbon. Christian Berger, an Austrian cinematographer, shot the film in black and white, and I have a feeling that's the film that's going to win.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised at that as being the upset. Though that great visual image of the Hurt Locker, where you see the guy surrounded by all the wires of bombs in the dirt coming up out of the ground, that sort of one great image sort of sticks in your head. And I'm gonna go with the Hurt Locker, because I didn't like The White Ribbon. What about you, Karen?
Avatar.
How'd we do?
The Cinematographers Guild voted for The White Ribbon, which was considered a big surprise. which leads you to think that they're favoring a European, they're favoring a black and white, and a very beautiful, beautiful movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably Avatar, but this could be any one of three. It could be Avatar, it could be Hurt Locker. It could be four. Anything but Harry Potter could win this.
Yeah, what's Harry Potter even doing in here?
Well, no, the look of Harry Potter and the production design are why that's the best film, I think, since Prisoner of Azkaban. I did think the look of it, for once, it looked like an actual world rather than a theme park ride. And I thought that was really important for making that movie successful.
Yeah, Half-Blood Prince. I mean, the cinematography on that film is just extraordinary. It's great that got nominated, but... I'm leaning towards the white ribbon here. I was thinking Avatar all the way until the cinematographers threw this loophole into things. Four of the last five films to win that award have won the Oscar. And I think everyone loves, you know, it's like, ooh, black and white, you know.
Exactly.
So I have a hunch that the white ribbon is going to pull an upset here.
The only thing that's really interesting about this is that Avatar, you know, for all the extraordinary achievement, and there a lot of people in the Academy, especially the cinematographers, that's why it didn't win the cinematographers. They have issues with the fact that it's a computer-generated movie for the most part, and
it's
that all
a cartoon.
The swooping camera moves and the inventions and all this, is a lot of it's virtual, and so it's almost a threat to, you know, conventional cinematography. So part of the problem here is, how is the entire Academy going to feel about that? You know, are they all threatened by it, or is it just the cinematographers? That could be a factor. And the other factor is that the Hurt Locker is very handheld, very gritty, very brilliant, I think, brilliantly done, but maybe not as grand in scope as some of the movies that would be. Of all of them, you know, Avatar is certainly beautiful, but are they going to credit the cinematography? That's the question.
And can I say, Inglourious Basterds looks amazing as well. But I'm wondering, do any of you know, when you fill out your ballot, doesn't it begin with the best picture? And psychologically, when you check off Avatar or Hurt Locker or whatever it may be, doesn't that sort of influence you when you're going down, you know, you've checked it, you said it's the best film of the year, and sort of that's how they get the momentum and have those sweeps. But doesn't that sort of get you in the zone of thinking, well, that's the best movie of the year, and you start to check off those other boxes?
It might have been that in the past, but now there's 10, and they have to rank them 1 through 10, and
that's
there's a lot
true.
Of confusion about that. So it isn't just a question of picking one.
Oh, you're right. So they rank them. That could help them be more selective in the other categories, because it's depressing when one movie wins 12 awards.
It's not going to, you know, there's only 9 anyway that are, you know, for each one of the two top. Contenders, but it's also, I think it's going to be, I think they do go, I'm going to give Inglourious Basterds this one, and I'm going to give Hurt Locker that one, and I'm going to give Avatar that one. I think that could happen.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of splits. There's not going to be, I don't have any film winning more than 4 awards this year. I think you're going to see everyone get a little taste of a little something here and there. And cinematography is one of those categories that it does not exactly line up always with the best picture, unless you sort of have this sort of, you know, grand, you know, sweeping sort of, you know, thing like Titanic, or, you know, things like that. It's just not, you know, there's only, I think, like 3 films over the last 10 decade that have won best picture and won best cinematography. So it's just, it's not, I don't, that's why, you know, Avatar, Hurt Locker, I'm going with white ribbon.
Well, and the Cinematography Award is often seen as kind of a lifetime achievement award for cinematographers. Now, Best Art Direction, Avatar is nominated. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus is nominated. 9, Sherlock Holmes and the Young Victoria. And as much as I like Sherlock Holmes, I think it's going to be Avatar. I think this is one of those, well, we'll just give it to Avatar. The whole thing was drawn.
I'm going to say it's the Young Victoria. You put anything in a stately home and they love to vote for it. Karen?
I say Avatar because this is the only category that I think Avatar should win. Should win, not will win.
Yeah, I'm going with Avatar myself. I think it's, you know, once everyone sort of, you know, agreed that, you know, it could compete in this category, everyone went, well, okay, then I'll vote for it.
Yeah, for those of you filling out your ballots, this is the one that I think Avatar is pretty safe here.
But it looks terrible. It looks like a ridiculous, it's all pink and purple. But anyway.
Yeah, but that's your opinion.
Yeah.
I went to see it again on IMAX 3D this weekend, and I was in heaven.
Were you asleep?
I was happily in Pandora. That's why I was in heaven.
Yeah.
And if I die and end up on Pandora, I'll know I'm in hell.
Yeah.
Well, now, do you think Nick Park is safe in the best short film animated? And normally we wouldn't cover this, but I just had to because Nick Park has won, I think, every time he's been nominated. He's the animator behind Wallace and Gromit and several other, I guess, feature films. There is I'm forgetting the Flushed Away.
Right. Yeah. That was for shorts. He's got a full sweep. I definitely think Nick Park's going to win for A Matter of Loaf and Death. And that instead of Abracadabra, we'll win the live-action short. I think those are both very strong. If there's an upset in animated short, I think it'll be Logorama, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I would go with Nick Park just for – I love the guy. Karen?
Same here. Yeah, Nick Park just because I like him.
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like such an easy choice, and everyone is really talking about this Logorama thing. It's really sort of – there's a little groundswell of support for this thing, and I don't know. This is where I'm going to – put an upset in and say Logorama is going to win. It's just because Nick Park has won every time.
It's not the kind of thing they tend to go for.
That's true. So, but considering that I haven't seen any of the shorts, no one has bothered to send me, you know, a copy of any of the shorts. You know, I have very little knowledge of any of them. So,
I've seen them all, and they show them in theaters now across the country. So a lot of people have a chance now to see them, and it's usually pretty obvious. I mean, in live action short, instead of Abracadabra. Has a great ending. It's funny. It's by far and away the best short. The only possibility of an upset is the new Tenants because it has some Hollywood actors in it, some named people. But I don't think
the new Tenants will win, although it was my favorite by far. It was the
I hated
the
it.
Smartest. Oh, I loved it. But I actually think that the one that will win is the one that's called The Door.
Oh my God, you're high.
Wow.
And he says that lovingly.
Because the secret of picking the live action shorts is which one makes the most of the people who've seen them cry. That's what wins. It's about emotion. It's not about what's the best made or the most beautifully made. And the one that's a comedy is the least likely to succeed.
I'll bet you a dollar instead of Abracadabra that The Door does not win. I won't take all the other four, but I think it was the weakest of the five.
I didn't like it that much either, but it's the one that is both beautifully made and emotional at the same time. And even that first one, Kavi, the one with the slavery
in India. Yes.
That would get a lot of those Academy members going as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that pegs right into the documentary features, where often a film about a particularly pressing topic can score with viewers. So you have like The Cove, which is about the slaughter of dolphins, which could move a lot of people, and it's very well made. And Food Inc., which is about the food industry, and Burma VJ obviously has social relevance. So which of the five films for best documentary do you think will win? My pick is, I think, the Jewish angle, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers.
Food Inc., because I think this is a subject that is peaking right now.
This one is a toss-up for me. I think it's either, I guess Burma VJ it's already kind of peaked, and I would have to say Food Inc. as well. But it could be any one of the three, The Cove, Burma VJ, or Food Inc., in my opinion.
I'm going to say it's The Cove.
Yeah, I think that's The Cove. It's one of the locks of the night, I think. I don't think anything else is going to come close. It has the subject matter. It was very well received. I don't think anything.
It's won everything. Right, just about.
Exactly.
I should stop being such a contrarian. Maybe I'm, for the sake of time, going to skip over a few categories like best makeup and best original song. Now, best original score. I think this is a lock as well. Nominated are Avatar, Fantastic Mr. Fox, The Hurt Locker, Sherlock Holmes, and Up. And I think my old friend Michael Giacchino will win for Up. He's won every other award. Why not this one?
I think that's a lock as well. Up and The Weary Kind is equally a lock for the best original song.
I agree on both.
As do I.
Me too.
Well, that was easy.
Go to your bookies, people, and place a bet.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about best foreign language film? We have a film called Ajami, which is from Israel. From Argentina, we have El Secreto de Sus Ojos, The Secret of Your Eyes, I guess is what that translates to. The Milk of Sorrow from Peru. Un Prophète from France and The White Ribbon from Germany. Now, I'm going to go with the right White Ribbon, but this past weekend at the César Awards, Un Prophète won. It kind of swept everything, director, actor, and best film.
Well, A Prophet was the best film of that I saw in 2009, and it will be on my best of the list for 2010 since it came out theatrically in February. But The White Ribbon is the obvious pick, but it almost never is the obvious pick in foreign language film. You think, well, that won all the awards. Everybody's seen it. Everybody talks about it. And it ends up being something like The Milk of Sorrow, you know, that someone's no one's seen. Ajami is Israeli, but it's kind of really dark and depressing. I wish it was A Prophet. I would love that. But I'm going to go with just something nutty and just say Ajami, just because it's not the movie that I assume it will be, which is The White Ribbon. Karen?
I'm going with The White Ribbon because I think the black and white thing is going to play in here.
It isn't cinematography.
Guess. Total guess.
I actually agree with a lot of what you said. The thing with the foreign film category is that you can't pick it, really. It's not the obvious thing. But what it often is the thing that, again, I hate to put it this way so simplistically, but it's the thing that makes people emotionally moved. And I don't think Ajami accomplishes that. And I also think Ajami is very hard to follow, very difficult to follow, very well made. I admire it. And I also share your love for A Prophet. I adore the movie. It's extraordinary. The best thing from last year, too. But I don't. The White Ribbon is not a moving movie. It is a very cerebral movie. And even though the sort of underpinning of the Holocaust is in there and is part of why the Academy might go for it, and it is very beautiful, I'm going to go with the movie that seems to be the most moving for everyone, and that's the Argentinian film, The Secret of Your Eyes. Ooh. Is that the title?
Secret of Her Eyes, My Eyes, Her Their Eyes, something like that. Secret of Somebody's Eyes. That's as good logic as anything. I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes they avoid the sort of the harsher, you know, film in this category and they go with something soft. You know, I mean, look at last year, Departures won, and which also sort of feeds into the idea that the film that everyone just sort of expects is going to sort of just sweep this category and no one's even going to get a vote for anything else, you know, tends to lose. I've been thinking White Ribbon for a while, but, you know, everyone thought Waltz of Bashir was going to win last year, and then this Departures won. You go back to 2006, everyone was really high on Pan's Labyrinth, and then The Lives of Others won, much more deserving as far as I'm concerned. This is a total sort of hunch guess kind of thing, and I think everyone seems to love A Prophet. It's out in theaters. It's been sort of got this little stream going right now. So I have a hunch on Prophet's going to win.
Now I'm going to skip over Best Adapted Screenplay just because I think everybody believes Jason Reitman and Sheldon Turner will win for Up in the Air since they've won every other award.
Agreed.
Yep.
Best Original Screenplay nominated is Mark Boal for The Hurt Locker, Quentin Tarantino for Inglourious Basterds, Alessandro Cimone and Oren Moverman for The Messenger, Joel Coen and Ethan Coen for A Serious Man, Pete Docter, Bob Peterson, and Tom McCarthy for Up. I think this is a toss-up. I think Joel and Ethan Coen have already won their Oscar. I think Quentin Tarantino's won an Oscar, but that might be the only Oscar that he would win that night.
Except for Christoph Waltz.
Except for Christoph Waltz. Yeah, maybe Mark Boal for The Hurt Locker.
I'm going to say Inglourious Basterds because it was a great screenplay.
This is a tough one for me. I think Hurt Locker.
It is. It's a close race, but I think Inglourious Basterds is going to win. I think people view Hurt Locker more of a director's film than a writer's film, and Inglourious Basterds is, you know, certainly is both. But I think they're going to reward Quentin here again.
I am going with Quentin on this one, but I'm not sure. I can tell you that. A lot of people think it's Boal. A lot of people, I mean, my logic is that Boal is young. He's not really a member of the fraternity, and Quentin's very popular, and he's not going to win Best Picture or Director, so they're going to give it to him here. And I do think that's what's going to happen, but it's not for sure.
In the acting categories, I think they're all locks except for actress. Obviously, Monique will win Supporting Actress, Christoph Waltz will win Supporting Actor, and Jeff Bridges will win Best Actor. So the question is Best Actress.
Wait a second. We should say, does everybody agree with that? I certainly do.
I agree with that. I think that is. I agree. I think you take that to the bank.
Yeah, I do too.
So the question is Best Actress. Who wins, Sandra Bullock or Meryl Streep? My pick is still Sandra Bullock, though I'm hearing people saying, well, you know, the Globes and is a little more low rent and Academy voters are thinking the movie's not worth it. But I think both movies are not great. So I just think it's Sandra Bullock's year with all the box office success she's had. And she made that film a hit. So I'm going with her.
Sperling, I agree.
Karen agrees. Sperling, what do you think?
I'm going to go with Sandra Bullock because I think that Hollywood wants to reward someone who took a pay cut to star in The Proposal and didn't get her quote, and then pushed so hard to get The Blind Side made and didn't get paid her quote for that either, and yet has made a fortune for Hollywood this year.
She actually didn't push hard to get The Blind Side made. They had to convince her to come on board for that.
Oh, really? Okay. I take all that back except that I still think she's going to win.
Yeah. No, that's true. She's extremely popular and just incredibly well liked for a long time. She's worked with a lot of people over the years, and I think she will win. But it's a close again. It's a close race. If Streep came in, you know, it wouldn't be a shocker.
Yeah, this is one of the categories, maybe the category that's going to make me vomit on Oscar night. I like Sandra Bullock. I've liked her for a long time, but, you know, The Blind Side was such a turd of a movie. And it's like Meryl Streep is like, what, you know, it's like they think that they've given her like 16 nominations, that, you know, that's reward enough when she hasn't won since 1982. And for my money, she gave, you know, I thought she gave the best performance in Julia, no matter how mediocre that movie was. She made it half good.
In the whole movie, and it's not the best thing she's ever done. And it isn't nominated
for
Best Picture.
Yeah. I think The Blind Side, The Blind Side getting nominated for Best Picture, though, was just sort of because of its popularity. It had nothing to do with people really, you know, critics really liking that movie. I think the Sandra Bullock train is there. You know, it's just she's like you said, she's well-liked. She didn't just win the Globe, she did win the SAG Award, and those are always very hard to bet against. So I think she was going to win, but I'm going to vomit.
Well, before you vomit, could you tell us, we skipped over Best Animated Feature, but I think we're all in agreement that Up is going to win that award.
Correct.
Up.
I mean, it's the only...
It'd be stupid if it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it was nominated for Best Picture, for Pete's sake.
Right. Yeah.
Now, looking at two of the toss-ups of the night, Best Director... Catherine Bigelow, who would be the first woman to ever win the award. James Cameron, who, of course, everybody, well, he's already won an award. Let's put it that way. For Avatar. Lee Daniels for Precious. Jason Reitman for Up in the Air. And Quentin Tarantino for Inglourious Basterds. I'm going to go with Catherine Bigelow on this one.
I'm going with Catherine Bigelow.
Catherine Bigelow, because we don't want to hear James Cameron speak Na'vi on the Oscar broadcast.
It's her turn. She's going to win it. There's no way she won't win it. But I would like to argue that if this were a normal year and there were five pictures vying for Best Picture and she weren't in the race, Avatar would win Best Director. I can't say what would happen. It's just one of these things where no one else could have done it but Jim Cameron. And I want Catherine Bigelow to win because it's long overdue and I'm very excited, but she's winning because she's a woman.
Yeah, this is Bigelow's award to lose. You know, I mean, Cameron's already won one. Reitman and Tarantino have been nominated before. Lee Daniels, everyone knows, is, you know, bringing up the rear in this category. Bigelow's going to win. She won the DGA award. It's only six times in the history of that award has the winner not won. And two of those six times, the person wasn't even nominated. So, you know, she's got like a 93% percentage rate in her favor. So Catherine Bigelow wins this in a walk.
Well, okay, then maybe we should take bets on how long it will take the technical director of the Oscars telecast to cut to a shot of James Cameron, Catherine Bigelow's ex-husband, watching her give her acceptance speech.
2 seconds.
And he's been very gracious about wanting her to win it, so...
Yeah, but this is one of those areas though that's really sort of got under my skin through the last couple weeks of the Oscar race, where you got Harvey Weinstein, you know, giving this crap, just like, you know, give Bigelow the director and we give us Best Picture, and Cameron has said the same thing, and the idea that basically, you know, ignore the history of the moment, you know, or the quality of the film for a moment, and he had these two jackasses condescending, you know, just saying like, yeah, give the woman this. But give us the big prize. No, screw you. That's how I feel.
Well, Well, I think Harvey Weinstein alienated a lot of people, saying, you know, the actors are going to make Inglourious Basterds Best Picture, you know, and, you know, if you vote for Inglourious.
He got a lot of journalists in his pocket, too.
Well, it was, I found it horrifying, to tell you the truth.
Well, I found it smart, you know. I mean, he probably got the reader Best Actress by touting it up as Best Picture. And now in all the tout-ups of who's in the running, everybody includes Inglourious Basterds, where before it was a two-horse race.
Well, speaking of horse races, Best Picture is probably the biggest horse race and hardest, for me at least, category to call. Nominated 10 films this year: Avatar, The Blind Side, District 9, An Education, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, Precious, A Serious Man, Up, and Up in the Air. Now, everybody believes it's really a race between Avatar and The Hurt Locker, but based on the way they're tallying the votes, a real surprise could wind up happening in this category.
So who's your pick, Sperling?
I'm going to go with Avatar.
God help us. Karen?
I'm going with Avatar, even though I hated the movie.
I should always go with the movie that would upset me the most to win, because that's what Oscar usually does, which means Avatar will win. I'm going to pick The Hurt Locker, but my upset is Up in the Air because of how they're doing the balloting. If I was filling out a ballot, I would have Hurt Locker and Glorious Bastards, you know, up towards the top. I would have Avatar at number 10. I think people who don't like it would put it at the bottom. I don't think it's like, oh, I really like it, but I slightly like this one more. I think you either love it or hate it. And I think a lot of people will treat it as an animated film or just not a great, it's just not a good movie. But I think people who hate it really hate it. But whereas I think people who love Hurt Locker or Avatar also really like Up in the Air and Inglourious Basterds. And I think those were going to be in the 2 and 3 slots and 4 slots for a lot of people. I think Up, A Serious Man, Precious, An Education, District 9, The Blind Side, those are all at the bottom. But when you're filling your thing out, Up in the Air, I think that plays really well at home. I think the older Oscar voters will love it. It's a classic Hollywood film that plays well on TV. It's like a Billy Wilder film. And I think that's going to be in the second and third category for a lot of folks. So if there's an upset because of the new balloting system, I think it could be Up in the Air. But The Hurt Locker will win.
Yeah, I agree. The Hurt Locker is going to win. I'll throw a little statistic out at you. Hurt Locker has won the Producers Guild Award, won the Directors Guild Award, and also won the Cinema Editors Award. Okay, in the history, since the inception of the Producers Guild Awards, that has happened 9 times. Okay, 8 times the film won Best Picture. The only time it didn't happen was Saving Private Ryan in 1998, and we all know, you know, that award was stolen. So.
I find that this 10-picture ballot thing is really hard to figure out, and I don't like it. I don't like the idea that it's impure, that people are just not picking their favorite, and that the very kind of logic that you were describing is, in fact, going to apply. And I find it, I find this year is very anomalous. In other words, you have a very small movie that has won everything, and the statistics are very much in the Hurt Locker's favor. I mean, if you follow the tea leaves in the statistics, you pick Hurt Locker. But because Kathryn Bigelow is being given the director's prize, I can't help but wonder if a lot of people, I'm so sorry, aren't going to go
is that
with
Kathryn Bigelow?
Avatar. I'm just going to hang up on them. Aren't going to go with Avatar. And that's, I can't explain the logic of it. But even when I start to say that logic is the old way, the old way would be pick one for Best Picture. If everybody's voting 10, you can't figure it out. You can't figure it out. And it makes me crazy. So what am I picking? I'm going to pick The Hurt Locker for the moment. But I could change my mind.
And I will say, looking at the box office gross, if The Hurt Locker wins Best Picture, it will be the lowest grossing Best Picture winner since The Apartment, Billy Wilder's film in 1960. That's a long time since a movie that grossed this little money has won Best Picture.
Okay, I love how people are sort of framing that as a negative for The Hurt Locker. It's like, oh, it's the lowest grossing movie compared to the highest grossing, you know, movie that would ever be, you know, to win that award. And it's just, I mean, you know, everyone's trying to create an angle, as they always do in the Oscars, just like they do with the Olympics, and everyone wants to sort of frame it in a certain way. And, you know, like Up in the Air, you know, the idea that, you know, this is a film for our times, it's a film about, you know, layoffs and the economy and all this kind of stuff. It's like, well, you know, why doesn't anyone apply that logic to The Hurt Locker's low box office gross? Here's the mom and pop store defeating, you know, the big corporation. You know, it's just, you know, a film that wasn't even, didn't even have distribution when it played at the Toronto Film Festival in 2008. So, yeah. So, I mean, it's just, it's, you know, if you want to send that message, you know, I mean, there you go.
Yeah, but what really matters is that everybody in the Academy saw The Hurt Locker, and what really matters is that it's been validated by all these guilds, as you pointed out. And the other thing is that it's the kind of movie that is serious and important and topical and contemporary that the Academy, you know, tends to reward in this kind of situation. Avatar being sci-fi, fantasy. And also threatening in some way in terms of its technology is not the the fact that it's such a huge grosser is not necessarily an advantage.
Yeah, tell it to some of the journalists out there though.
Well, certainly, I'm speaking for all of us here. I appreciate both of you giving us so much time. We went way longer than we expected. Anne Thompson from IndieWire, her blog can be found. I always give people the link thompsononhollywood.com, which takes you right to the blog. I don't know, is that
that's the right one.
Okay. Now you're also doing Oscar Talk with Chris Tapley. What's going to happen to that podcast once the Oscars are over?
I have a hunch. I mean, we could take a break, I suppose, but my hunch is that we're going to continue doing it on other subjects because it's really fun to do. I enjoy it. He enjoys it. And, I think we'd have plenty to talk about every week. So I'm sort of hoping that happens. Like, and if I go to a film festival or something, you know, he can ask me what's going on at the film festival. And I think that would be fun to do.
Now, Eric, you can be found on Cinematical as well as eFilm Critic. You've been doing Critic Watch since 2000. And we kind of brought that up last week when we talked about Paul Fisher and the little scuffle that he had. I'll just leave it at that. Now, speaking of film critics, did you guys read, I know, Anne, you did, but the article in Esquire on Roger Ebert, which has a phenomenal picture of him. And I think that's going to be the picture that is remembered years from now of him. And I mean, decades down the road, that was a phenomenal picture. It was a great piece.
They've added some new photos to it too, because it's done, you know, obviously it's gotten an enormous amount of attention and Ebert's all over the place. He's on Oprah today using his new voice machine.
Yes, that's right. He actually, because his voice was recorded a lot, he did at the movies for, I think, 2 decades, there is a group in the UK that can take the recording of somebody's voice, somebody who I guess planned ahead to know they weren't going to have a voice, and turn it into that Stephen Hawking robotic voice. But instead of the robotic voice, it's going to be Roger Ebert's voice.
There's a clip online right now that you can see of him actually using it for the first time with his wife, Chaz, who hadn't heard him speak since July 1st, 2006. And I challenge you not to shed a tear.
Aww.
Well, I go to Eberfest every year, so I'm looking forward to seeing them.
I was just saying, I'm here in Chicago, so I see Roger pretty frequently. His Eberfest is coming up next month again. Yeah, you read that Esquire article, and that's piece. You know, it's hard to, you know. I think people are going to remember, picture-wise, they'll remember him from the movies and all those years. But the picture that's on the cover is certainly a very sort of going to be an iconic sort of remembrance long after he's gone, which hopefully won't be for a long time.
I'm with you.
And I thought it was very interesting how that piece was so intimate, and it showed how, even though he is been crippled, at least the ability to talk, because of they removed his jaw due to cancer, that what it has allowed him to do in writing and become such a better writer, he's actually really happy.
He's also really active on Twitter.
Yes, he is.
Very much so. And it's wonderful because he has, you know, an incredible number of followers, and he's also when you go on to his website and you see his blog, you see the incredible numbers of people who comment and who love him and everything. And I did a critics panel this weekend with Richard Schickel and Peter Rayner and John Powers and Ella Taylor and Dave Starrett and Jared Perry, whatever. But I brought up Roger Ebert, and I brought him up as this sort of new model critic who's in touch with his fans, who isn't speaking from on high. And they were trying to argue with me that he wouldn't have become so powerful online if he hadn't had the profile that had been established at the movies. And I said, no, I think he would have done it anyway. I think he's in there communicating in a very powerful way. His voice is very strong.
And he's now doing it on the political side.
Well, he's talking about whatever he wants to talk about, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone talks about the disconnect between critics and just general moviegoers and whatnot, and whether it be through his reviews or his blog or on Twitter, I mean, Eve is really, it's the perfect bridge, exactly what you want out of a film critic who, he speaks his mind, he's not going, talking down to you. And he's going to communicate. And I'm like, I read about that panel that you were on, Anne, and I don't think anyone's going to be following Ridicule anytime soon unless they can find where Clint Eastwood's butthole is, and then they can find his nose where it is. So,
all right. So that's good. That's good.
On that note, thank you both very much for joining us. And we will place links to your blog and your podcast, Anne, and all of your writing, Eric, in our show notes.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Well, it's nice of Ann and Eric to spend the time talking with us. I'm certainly looking forward to watching the Oscars, even though I'm a little wary of the show because they were going to put Sacha Baron Cohen, aka Borat, as the host, and that's such a bad idea. I'm glad the Oscar people rejected it. So I'm not quite sure how great it's going to be, but I have been watching the Olympics and really enjoying that.
Olympics. Love this Olympics.
I had a blast. And if you watch the Olympics at all, you saw a million ads for the return of Jay Leno.
Yes, indeed. And he did return last night, Monday night. We're recording a day late this week. But Leno picked up right where he left off, according to you, Michael. 5.4 was his rating.
That song that they played in the promos was so incredibly insulting. Get back to where you once belonged. That's so insulting to Conan O'Brien.
Oh, I know.
he said it's good to be home was practically the first line he said when he came up on stage. And the point I would make was that people were saying, oh, my God, celebrities aren't going to go on a show. He's got such a bad rep. Please. His show is on. He's a success. Jamie Foxx was open there the first night. He broke open champagne. He had the crowd singing along. When I say welcome, you say back. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Yeah, just get King of the Douchebags to be the first guest for King of the Douchebags. That's perfect.
Jamie Foxx?
Oh my God.
What's wrong with Jamie Foxx?
A total douchebag.
What has he done? He's a douchebagginess. But anyway, Lindsey Vonn was a guest and Brad Paisley. Tuesday night is Sarah Palin and Shaun White. Wednesday is Apollo. I know Karen will be watching that. And Avril Lavigne and Chelsea Handler. Thursday is Matthew McConaughey and Jason Reitman. Friday is Morgan Freeman, Meredith Vieira. Obviously, you're on and you're a hit. People are going to watch you. He beat David right out of the bat. So things look, if this turns out that he is at the same level where he was before he left, NBC will shed the biggest sigh of relief imaginable.
Yes, that is true. And I really liked his skit on trying to find a desk, because I guess during primetime he didn't have a desk, which I always thought was a huge mistake. But so he didn't have a desk on that set, and he went and found a desk, and he knocked on people's doors in Burbank, and I thought that bit was
kind of funny.
Would
have been funny if he'd borrowed Conan's, wouldn't it?
I feel like this was just the stupidest mistake on NBC's part imaginable. You can blame Jay or all you want, but basically they panicked over their number two guy and kicked out their number one guy and screwed up everything. They screwed up primetime. They screwed up late night. They angered a million people. They possibly did potentially damaged their brand. They should be thrilled that Conan refused to move the show back to midnight, because that could have been a disaster. So all in all, they should just, they've been complete idiots. And if it turns out Jay will settle in for another decade, at least he's not going anywhere. So if they can have him for another decade, they will just be very, very lucky.
I thought it was very telling that the guy is making jokes about Alan Greenspan, the former Secretary of the Treasury. I thought, wait a second. You're making a joke about a guy who's no longer in office, who's 83. I mean, that tells you who your audience is.
Yeah, oh no, he's always been middle America and a little behind the times, no question about
it. Yeah, middle America doesn't know who Alan Greenspan is.
he's never had the critics, he's never had, the elites. He's always been a bread and butter guy. And that's who he is, and that's his humor, and that's what he's doing, and he's been wildly successful. And if he can stabilize these ratings, that will be huge. I imagine they'll drop a bit because he doesn't have the lead in, of course. But I'm looking forward to seeing Parenthood, so maybe that'll be a good lead-in.
Parenthood got great reviews.
I'm looking forward to Parenthood.
Well, we are running long on time today because we talked to Anne and Eric for so long, which I'm not regretting a single minute of it. So maybe we just go right
into the Oscars. We have to talk about the Oscars.
That's true.
I am bummed that they're not doing the best musical performance. I think that's a shame because I would have loved to hear Ryan Bingham sing The Weary Kind.
Oh, that's, me too. That would have been beautiful.
And Randy Newman and Dr. John doing two songs from his, you know, it's a shame.
Well, I was going to suggest we head right over to Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we decide whether the news stories in this case from the past 2 weeks are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. This week, our first story is about the Hollywood Stock Exchange, a site I used to work for. It can be found at hsx.com. And it was a game that started in 1996-97, where you could kind of bet on the opening box office and the box office returns for a given film.
And on actors. I bet on actors. I remember
they
had stock in Angelina Jolie, and my God, I had like so many points.
Yeah, do you remember back in 97, 98? This was like the hottest thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of disappeared. Now, Cantor Fitzgerald purchased them, and they purchased them right before 2001. And of course, they were located in the World Trade Center and lost, I think, 700 people in their company to 9/11. And I guess now they're trying to turn their site into a futures trading site.
I think that was why Hollywood Stock Exchange, you know, it lost its luster because you could get all these points, but you didn't really get anything for it.
Yeah, I mean, you got these Hollywood dollars.
Just, they didn't have a leaderboard or anything, or maybe they did. But
they did.
It seemed weird because you had all this fake money. It wasn't even like they tried to couch it as points. It was like, this is your money, but like you didn't have money, and it was frustrating.
So is it a big deal or a big whoop that they're launching it back this way?
I think this is a big deal. Huge deal.
I think it's a big whoop until I see how people respond to it, because I think it's a little too confusing for people.
I think just the idea that they're doing it, I think it's the biggest deal. Okay, the next story
I
put
a big whoop.
I'm sorry.
I think it's a big whoop because everybody covers the box office. It should have established itself a decade ago, and its time has passed.
Moving on.
The next story was mine, that Hulu is going to start doing original programming. The American Idol the producer of American Idol has a show that's going to be premiering on Hulu today, March 2nd. It's called If I Can Dream, and it is about a group of Hollywood hopefuls trying to make it in the big, scary city. And I watched the promo of it, and it actually looks sort of entertaining. But I think this is a big deal because this is Hulu's first foray into original programming.
I think it's a big deal for that very same reason. I think old media is finally getting smart and figuring out how to utilize new media to make money. Michael.
I think it's a big deal. Just every website of this nature is going to need original programming. Just like every cable channel lived for a while off reruns. And then eventually they realized they've got to have original programming to get them to come to USA and TNT and Bravo and whoever you are. Everybody needs original programming. So it's a big deal.
Well, this next story, I don't even know how to...
Just to say it.
Okay, well, William Shatner will star in... insert beep here, My Dad Says, and that beep should begin with the letter S, not B. And it should probably end, maybe, it should have like three other letters in it, and maybe one of them could be a T.
Anyway, Twitter sensation Shit My Dad Says is now being made into a TV series, and William Shatner is going to star as the dad.
Well,
maybe we could say the title just like the Electric Company. I'll say shh, and Sperling, you say it. Shh.
It.
There you go. Now
My Dad Says. There you go.
I think it's a big deal. I think it's a great fit for William Shatner. I think he's a great choice.
I think it's a phenomenal choice. I mean, call it typecasting, call it whatever you want. It's a perfect choice. Now, this is a show that came basically out of some 29-year-old named Justin Halpern moved back into his parents' house in San Diego and on August 3rd launched a Twitter feed titled... you know, what we just said, Stuff My Dad Says, and it was often profane, and basically it just spewed out things his dad said, but they were hilarious sayings. And now he's this internet celebrity. The pilot has been greenlighted with Shatner starring, David Kohan and Max Muchnick who I guess did Will and Grace, are producing the show. It's set up at CBS. It's a go. And I think this is a big deal.
Yeah, but bear in mind, though, that Justin Halpern was the editor-in-chief of, Michael, you probably know, Esquire, or some kind of mail magazine, the online version of it. It's not like he came out of nowhere.
Right, so he's a good writer.
No, yeah, more power to him, but more power to him. I feel like I should need to work on my tweets. I'm waiting for celebrities to hire people to write their tweets. I see that happening. We're going to have writers to craft tweets.
You're talking to the queen of social media, remember?
Yeah.
No, I know people write them, but I mean the sense of creative talent, not just like an assistant or whatever, saying, you know, I'm a professional tweet writer, and therefore I can write crafty, smart, clever tweets for you, and they'll hire me to spice up their tweets that their assistant is churning out.
Well, it happens.
Well, you know, record companies are now putting it in the contract that you have to go on social media to promote your record.
Oh, it's in TV contracts now, too.
Wow.
And I've been advising my agent friends to make it very clear about whether they have to tweet as the character they play, or do they have to tweet as themselves and talk about the TV show they're on? Because there's a huge difference. One is creative, one is PR.
Can I get a job simply writing tweets?
I do that.
No, I know, but you do lots of other things. There's nobody hired simply to write tweets, is there? They don't pay somebody X amount of a year just to write a tweet.
Why don't you ask John Cleese's assistant? He does his tweets.
Oh, that's depressing. All right.
It is a job.
Cool. Well, the next item is mine. HBO just greenlit a pilot. Michael Mann is directing is overseeing the series. It's called Luck. It's set in the horse racing world, and it's going to star Dustin Hoffman. And I know movie stars are a dime a dozen on TV now, but somehow that still struck me as like, wow, Dustin Hoffman in a TV series. It's his first TV work in like 40 years, and I think it's a big deal. Karen?
Big whoop. Nobody cares about Dustin Hoffman.
Oscar winner Dustin Hoffman to you.
Yeah, I don't care. In the 80s. Maybe 70s.
Sperling?
Who's Dustin Hoffman? No, just kidding. I actually love Dustin Hoffman, even though apparently nobody cares about him. But I think it's a bigger deal, not necessarily because it's Dustin Hoffman, but because it's somebody of his caliber basically saying that there's not going to be enough film work out there for all these actors, especially me, since I'm now in my 60s. So I think it's a big deal that you're beginning to see these actors that were once considered A-list bankable stars beginning to look for work elsewhere. That's why it's a big deal.
HBO, Michael Mann. I mean, it's essentially a movie.
Yeah, it's very high class. Yeah, no, it's great.
I mean, if he was doing something for the CW, that would be different.
It's not a step down. The next one is mine. They are doing a remake of one of my favorite films of all time, Dudley Moore's comedy Arthur. And one of the guys who's directed a lot of episodes of the Modern Family sitcom, which Karen loves, Jason Weiner is directing. And the star is a big UK actor, Russell Brand. And I think it's a big deal because they're destroying one of my favorite films. And it's a ridiculously bad idea to remake it. And I'm just angry. I didn't even look at the sequel because I didn't want to spoil the love I had for the original. So it makes me very angry. So it's a big deal.
I'll go with a big deal, but just because it's Russell Brand and Jason Weiner.
I'm going to say big whoop because I hated the original. I will hate the remake.
Moving on, I told you that we were going to be talking about Kevin Smith again, and we'll just cover this one very briefly since it happened 2 weeks ago, but I couldn't leave it out. Bottom line, Kevin Smith was on a Southwest Airlines flight, and he got booted because he was too heavy. And rather than just take it lying down, he sent out a Twitter message to his 1.6 million followers, and it caused this big PR storm. Now, Karen, I know this is right up your alley, because it's one thing when, you know, you throw me off a flight because I'm too skinny, but, you know, you throw somebody off who can instantly talk to 1.6 million people, that might be a little bit of a mistake.
You know, Southwest has this rule in place. People know that Southwest has this rule in place. Not sure why Kevin Smith thought that he should be treated differently just because he was famous.
He didn't. And if you read Roger Ebert's piece on it and what Kevin Smith, I mean, he was not trying to gain. He turned down a lot of media requests for this. He was embarrassed by it. He did tweet about it originally, but he was not trying to gain tons of, you know, airtime for it, even though he was promoting a movie, Cop Out. And when you get the whole story, I have to take Kevin Smith's side. He did buy two seats originally. He wasn't trying to get away with anything. That they lied to him about who told him to get off the plane. It wasn't the pilot. This was not a simple question of him saying, hey, I'm famous, you can't kick me off. He bought two tickets originally. They transferred planes. He was willing to buy two tickets again. I think Southwest botched this up every level, including lying about who said what, where, and when. So I'm on Kevin Smith's side, as is Roger Ebert.
Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Karen?
Well, it's not that I'm not on his side. I get it, but I just...
He didn't ask for special treatment. He didn't ask for anything.
This is a big deal because it shows the power of social media.
Well, absolutely. I would agree with you on that. And I think it's a big deal for that reason. I also think it's a big deal because he managed to get a lot of attention right before his movie came out.
He
was invited on Larry King. He was invited on other stuff to talk about this, and he turned it down. So he was not trying to leverage this into attention. He was angry and he tweeted about it, and then that was it.
Our next story is about the Miss America pageant, which was recently dumped by its cable channel, TLC, the Learning Channel. It does not have a new home yet. The ratings were up strongly to 4.52 million viewers during this last year, the highest yet on cable. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because it's the end of an era. Even on an upswing, its ratings are not equal to like a single episode of Hannah Montana. This show, you know, it's beauty pageants are dead.
Karen?
I agree for the same reason.
I would agree for the very same reason. Big deal. Our next story is about NBC Universal and the Olympics. It turns out digital is the future, but TV is still king.
In a nutshell, what this story is that a lot of people watch more than... half of the people who watch the Olympics watch them online. Is that a big deal or a big whoop?
That is a big deal.
Huge deal.
I don't think it's that they only watch it online. I think it's that they watched it both online or that and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of it is people who watch something live and then later they show, hey, look at this, and they show them a thing online. I think it adds to the enjoyment of the games, but it does not replace that sitting there in prime time watching the game with a bunch of people as live as possible. So I think it's still the future. People thought it was the future 10 years ago, you know, when NBC was showing everything on live on every possible cable channel alive. So I think it shows the dominance of TV as that sort of everybody coming together. So I think it's a big deal that TV is still king, not that digital is the future.
I think it's a big deal that digital is the future because not only are people watching the Olympics online, but advertisers who bought spots both online and offline had a higher brand recall. And that, I think, speaks so much to advertising online.
And every time I saw McDonald's saying, this is where Olympians eat, I thought, oh, please.
But you are talking about this ad. That's recall.
Yep.
Well, I think it's a big deal. I think anything where you're shifting a paradigm or shifting the way viewers are watching and getting their information, it's a big deal. And I think that companies need to learn how to deal with this. They should probably hire you, Karen.
Tell them that.
Hey, I just gave you a plug. Well, that brings us to our inside baseball segment for this week. And we're going to discuss two inside baseball stories. Well, maybe three if you count a little Netflix story that we'll throw in at the end here. But the first, we talked a week or two ago about how Disney decided to move up the release date of their Alice in Wonderland DVD. Alice in Wonderland opens March 5th, this Friday, and they moved up the DVD release to 3 months rather than 4 months. So they're going to release it in June rather than in July. Now, what wound up happening is AMC didn't publicly threaten a boycott, but they certainly didn't sign an agreement to show the film in Europe. The exhibitors, the movie theater owners, went ballistic, and the Netherlands and Belgium are still boycotting it. All of the three largest cinema owners and cinema chains in the UK were going to boycott it, although Disney went over to the UK and struck a deal with Vue, Odeon, and Cineworld. So they're now going to show it. As well, in Italy, Disney was able to strike a deal. And some of the pieces that... or some of the points that they agreed to was they wouldn't advertise the DVD for the first 6 to 8 weeks of the film's theatrical release. They also agreed in Italy, Disney that is, agreed in Italy to release three tentpole blockbuster movies, or at least they hope they're blockbuster movies, during the summer when most Italians are not actually going to the movies. So they're going to release Prince of Persia on August 20th. They're going to release Toy Story 3 during the summer. And there was one other, The Sorcerer's Apprentice during the summer as well. And that's kind of goes against a long tradition, as does releasing the DVD 3 months after a theatrical release. What makes this a big deal, and I know we're off of big deal or big whoop, is that this could be precedent setting, and that all the studios have been trying to push the release window up from 4 months to 3 months for quite some time, because they spend millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, to promote a theatrical release, and then just 4.5, 5 months later, they've got to spend tens of million dollars all over again to promote a DVD release, and they'd like to shrink that window down. What movie theater owners, of course, are worried about is that people will just wait for the DVD. So,
well, what I really liked about your story in Sperling was how you showed that a story that would have just been an obscure industry thing, in fact, got a lot of play in the mainstream press, because people are really aware of this and how movies come out and release dates and DVD really, and they're really into it and they're really focused on it, just like they are in box office. So I found that kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I wrote two pieces about this. One, a recap of everything, and then one kind of where it stands with the UK and European exhibitors. On celluloidjunkie.com, we'll place links to them in the show notes. The other topic that we were going to discuss today, kind of, well, it's also about video in the home. Walmart, the discount chain, I guess is what you'd call them.
No, well, not a discount chain, they're a big box store.
Big box store. They bought a little box, Vudu. And that little box gets attached to your television and connected to the internet and allows you to stream movies over the internet on demand to your television. And I think this is kind of a huge deal. They bought this company. They've tried to sell movies online before and failed. They've tried to sell music online and aren't doing too well, from what I understand, although I'd have to double check my facts on that. But keep in mind, Walmart sells an enormous amount of televisions. Last year, less than 5% of televisions were high definition and connected to the internet, but 14.6% of all flat panel TVs were sold by Walmart. And I'm pretty sure that they kind of rule the DVD market.
Have you guys actually gone on to Vudu's site and seen what their options are?
No, I haven't.
No. Well, according to this article, Vudu has got relationships with some of the major studios, and therefore, in fact, most of the major studios, and they're going to be like 16,000 choices of movies. I went on there, totally not impressed.
Right.
It doesn't have a lot of recent movies. It's got movies that I think are placed in the wrong categories. Like, it's got like 9.5 weeks in romance, you know. I think there's something there, but I don't think it's there yet. But I do think it's a huge deal that Walmart this.
Does Vudu use the cable connection, or does it use streaming your high speed internet connection?
Streaming,
or
what does it use to work?
It streams it, and of course it does this like store and stream thing. So it begins streaming it, and it kind of caches it a little bit, and then it starts streaming it to your television set. And that's just so that it doesn't stutter if the internet connection goes down. But what it really means is that Amazon, which has a video on demand service that I use through TiVo, and Apple, which of course has the iPod and the Apple TV, these are devices that also connect to your TV. So all of these video on demand services that come through the internet, they're kind of clunky right now. You have to connect these separate boxes to your TV. But what's happening over time is that televisions are becoming internet capable. And so rather than have to connect all of these third party or additional devices to your television set, you can just connect the internet to your television set. And what that's going to mean is that people like, or companies such as Comcast and Time Warner, who are cable companies, or DirecTV, they're going to have a problem, because they make a lot of money from video on demand, and right now they rule that market.
All right. Just remember that 1/3 of all Americans do not have any sort of high-speed internet access in their home. That's according to the FCC.
Those are people who live in the sticks and in, you know, Alaska. I saw that. I was like, no way.
Absolutely. You kidding me? High-speed internet access is hard. And plus mine, if I try to watch just a trailer online, it has to pause and wait before it can all be played.
Well, one reason Walmart made this move is because DVD sales have begun to decline. And everybody knows that digital downloads and electronic streaming, that's what the future is. And so since they make a fortune selling DVDs, and because, ironically, the price of DVDs is declining due to them, they are looking for a way to keep that revenue stream alive. So good for them. They're thinking ahead. Bad for them that they let Redbox into their store, where people actually rent the movies for $1 per day. And
yeah, what's that about?
Well,
a dollar a day
irony,
is fine.
No, not Redbox. The fact that they've got Redbox in their store. I mean, what are they going to do now? Kick off Redbox?
No, it's all part. It's all, you make money off all of it.
Pretty much.
Whether
yeah.
people stream it or whether they buy a DVD or whether they rent a movie for a dollar a day, it doesn't matter. You just want to be in the business and make money. Give them the options and let people choose whatever they like. Redbox serves a great need and it will survive for a while at least. Streaming will work eventually. DVD sales work great. You know, if they stop carrying DVDs, yeah, DVD sales will keep going lower. But if you carry DVDs, it's still an $18 billion a year market. It's not, you know, the end of the world. And it's a lot easier to get all the extras and stuff on DVDs by getting the actual DVD. So there's a market for all of
this stuff. And all of those Luddites that you are such good friends with can use Redbox.
Well, yeah.
Well, when they use Redbox, they won't be able to watch a Warner Brothers release, at least not within the first 28 days. Redbox, like Netflix before it, has agreed to not stock Warner Brothers titles for the first 28 days of a DVD's release, giving Warner Brothers a chance for 28 days to sell the DVD to the public. Frankly, I think this is a losing proposition for Warner Brothers. People will just wait the 28 days. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, you know, if you rent, you rent. If you buy, you buy. It's a different thing.
Yeah, I agree. But I think it's interesting that Warner Brothers is even taking the initiative to do these kinds of deals.
Well, now that Warner Brothers has done it, other studios are going to jump on board, much the way Disney has kind of broken the four-month window on a home video release. Watch other studios and what happens now.
Well, they will, 4 months, 3 months. But again, if the movie's still in theaters and still making money, they'll delay the release.
Well, we're going to end today's show with a little listener email. We always threaten we're going to read it. Well, now we're going to read it. and believe it or not, this email comes from Stephanie the librarian, who is, I guess she's a librarian.
I'm picturing her wearing glasses and her hair done up, and she looks awesome.
Yep. Wow.
Okay, all that from just a name and a tagline. Okay, well, it has to do with our previous Inside Baseball topic. She writes, "Dear Sperling, Michael, and Karen, I've been listening to your podcast for a while now and think you guys do a great job covering a week's worth of industry news." I'm hoping she's talking about the entertainment industry, because if not, then we're in trouble. But thank you, Stephanie. That's why I was a little taken aback when I saw Paul Fisher's review of Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes. Yes, I saw this myself, actually. After you talked about his being caught plagiarizing some of his Sundance Festival reviews and treated him fairly on your show, he had the nerve to go and leave a negative comment on iTunes. The irony is, his review is the only negative one posted. For a guy who gave even the worst of movies positive reviews so he could be quoted in their ads, that's a compliment. Just wanted to let you know your hard work is appreciated. Love the show. Sincerely, Stephanie the Librarian." Stephanie, thank you very much. Thank you for the kind words. And Paul, now that I know you're listening, shame on you.
I'm surprised he didn't slam me. He actually criticized Karen, but he should have criticized me since I was the meanest to him. But I would, you know, there you go. It's feedback is appreciated from everyone.
Yes, although in this case, Paul's really proving the point here by showing that he is not a journalist, that he will go and review something.
There's nothing wrong with that, posting a comment on iTunes. He used his name. He didn't try and
good point, yes.
Disguise himself.
Yes, it's just not cool that he did that after he was a subject of one of the stories, and we invited him to appear on the show, and he declined.
Oh, well. Well, at least he listened.
Yes, and he's probably listening now. So to Paul and everyone else out there who wants to write to us, our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The phone number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can find links to any of the stories we talked about during today's show on our website. The website can be found at showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can subscribe to this podcast through your RSS reader or through iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. Look us up. And please feel free to leave a very positive review, 5 stars or more. I guess, what else should we say? Management, MGMT, does our music at the beginning and end. Not that they did it for us, but MGMT can be found on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, as always, can be found on michaelgiltz.com or on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. Karen is on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up, or you can find her work on KarenWoodwardOnline.com. I'm on Twitter. Feel free to look me up. At Sperling is my username. Heck, the show is on Twitter. At ShowbizSandbox is the username to look up. You can also find my writing on CelluloidJunkie.com, where the Alice in Wonderland recap can be found. Until next week, play nice.